It's Sunday morning, time for the great outdoors with Charlie Potter. Brought to you by the all-new Chevy Silverado and ChevyDriveChicago.com on Chicago's very own 720 WGN.
Good morning. Welcome to the Great Outdoors Show. Charlie Potter, your host here on WGN Radio. And let me be the first to remind all of you dads and husbands this morning, it's Mother's Day. And if you're saying all of a sudden, oh my God, I forgot, you have time to run out to the store and find a 24-hour Walgreens, CVS, or something of the kind, and buy a card and run home and give it to your wife before she wakes up. And if you didn't do that, well then, happy Mother's Day to all you mothers. This morning's show is one that I don't often get fired up when I'm going to do a show, but I'm really fired up this morning. Carrie Luft, who is the Executive Vice President of the Max McGraw Wildlife Foundation and leads the McGraw Center for Conservation Leadership, is going to be my guest this morning. And we're going to talk about a subject that is beginning to work its way through every element of the conservation movement discussion. And it's this thing called R3, which Carrie will describe in a second. And it's to do with this panic about where future hunters are going to come from. And I thought this morning, this is Mother's Day, we could talk about where are future hunters going to come from, and do we have the problem that many people perceive we have. And I'm not going to cast this in the position of we have a problem or we don't have a problem, but rather in the position of a discussion as to what's going on in the industry and how we have pivoted as a conservation world, and suddenly we perceive the loss of hunters as the number one problem we face, and it kind of comes out of nowhere. So with that introduction, good morning, Carrie. Thanks for being on the show.
Hi, Charlie. Thanks for having me.
And I know that because you're an extremely bright man, that you have your Mother's Day card. And when we are off the phone this morning, you will make sure that you've signed your Mother's Day card for your daughters, and that your beautiful wife has a happy Mother's Day. So happy Mother's Day to all you mothers, including my wife.
Excellent. Yes, Charlie. And unfortunately, as you pointed out, we have a few hours to make good on it.
So, Gary, what is going on with this R3? And maybe you could take a moment to describe what R3 is, and then we could have a discussion, and for all of you listening, understand why we're asking more questions than we have answers.
Okay. Charlie, as you know, I have very little tolerance for acronyms and such things, but or shorthand for what we're talking about. And I think R3 is a prime example of why. We hear it all the time, but I think outside of the industry of the outdoors, very few people know what it is. It stands for recruitment, retention, and reactivation. And as it relates to hunting, it breaks down like this. Recruitment is exposing people to hunting and giving them opportunities to try it. Retention is giving them the support to build skills until they participate on their own. And finally, reactivation is getting people who don't do the activity, in this case hunting. They once were hunters, they don't hunt anymore, and we get them back into it. So that, in a nutshell, is what R3 stands for. And there are a lot of underlying motivations driving this, but make no mistake, because of the way conservation in America is funded on the backs of fees paid for and taxes paid for by hunters and anglers and frankly, gun shooters who may or may not hunt, the dwindling numbers of hunters creates not only a problem for those of us who love the legacy of hunting, but it creates a huge problem for the agencies that deliver conservation on the state and federal level, because they are looking at a diminution of the monies that pour into their coffers every year at a very bad time for governments to have money in any, to raise money in any way, shape, or form. So it's not only a good thing trying to expose more people to hunting and get them involved in hunting or at least supportive of hunting. But it's also a crisis in that without more hunters, as we are currently configured, we're looking at a funding crisis for conservation in this country.
So, very well said, and I follow you in entirety. So the question I think that's surfacing around is, why do we have this quote-unquote crisis? And is it a diversion from the bigger crisis, which is that maybe we don't have enough things to hunt to keep people interested in hunting, or if we go at it another way, and that is we have fewer hunters, but they are much more active than they ever were. They travel around the country chasing turkey and deer and geese, and they're not stationary as they once were. Can we, in fact, achieve, let's just say this, and I agree with you, the R3, nobody, I mean, you said what it is, and most of us gloss over. So let's just go back to simple terms. Forget R3. Most of us understand that without people hunting, there may not be as much support for hunting. But if this effort, which is now in the probably hundreds of millions of dollars in money being spent, is actually successful, where are these hunters supposed to go and what are they supposed to hunt?
Charlie, how long is your show?
We have another 20 minutes.
Well, can I come back next week, the week after that, and the week after that? Because we might start scratching the surface of all the challenges that are here. Charlie, you are
You can come back anytime you'd like, Kerry, and we'll talk about this as long as you'd like. But let's see if we can do this in the next 20 minutes.
Let's do that. Okay, so you raised a lot of great questions. And I can tell you, in my experience working at McGraw, which is one of the leaders in hunter education, not just in the state of Illinois, but in America, we bring in lots of people every year for a free hunter safety class that's mandated by the state of Illinois and, frankly, by a lot of other states across the country before you can secure a hunting license. What is the number one question people ask after they go through this hunter safety course? Okay, what do I do now? They have no idea of where to go, how to go about it, how to do it, and that is not a recipe for success. And, you know, Charlie, we have to acknowledge the demographics of America have changed. Rural populations continue to decline. Urban populations continue to grow. And while you can certainly be an active hunter living in an urban area, you and I being two prime examples of that, you have to have access to a place where you can go and have a reasonable opportunity for success. Generations ago, Charlie, as you know, you had an uncle or a friend of a grandfather. You had a shirt-tail relative. You had a longtime friend who owned a farm, who owned a that might have a marshy spot in the back where you could sit out and have a reasonable chance to shoot a mallard or two. That's not happening the way it used to be. I have friends who are in their 70s who talk about coming home from school in Park Forest, Illinois, on the southern border of what was then the southern border of Chicagoland, coming home from school, whistling up their Cocker Spaniel, walking across the street, and shooting two pheasants by the time their father came home from work. Probably not a single pheasant, unless it's in somebody's pet collection, within 50 miles of Park Forest today. So what we're facing, Charlie, is a diminution in interest, a diminution in exposure, and a diminution in opportunity to have reasonable success in the field. And just having a hunter education / safety program is just one step in what is going to be a very long and very arduous process.
So let's do this. I want to take a quick break. And when we come back, I'd like to ask you, Kerry, and all of you listening, this is a participatory conversation this morning from the point of view, there aren't any right answers, there aren't any simple answers. And the question really is, so if we were successful at recruiting all these people that, that the state agencies and now conservation organizations think we so direly need to recruit, what are they supposed to hunt? If you can think about that while we're taking a quick break, Gary, then we'll talk about that a little bit. And as you mentioned, this is not a subject that we can cover in this morning's show, but I'm struck by the very quick pivot that the conservation movement and state agencies have made to suddenly say this is a crisis in search of a solution. When I wonder, is it a problem in search of a solution, or are we creating a problem that we know really can't be solved because it's a great way to divert from other issues, and it's a great way to raise money? We'll be back in just a moment with Carrie Luft, the Executive Vice President of the Max McGraw Wildlife Foundation and the leader of the McGraw Center for Conservation Leadership. But first, a message from our longtime sponsors in Chicagoland, the Northwestern Indiana, and Chicagoland Chevrolet dealers.
In the field, hunters need to be alert, sense the environment around them, and know exactly where they are, communicate seamlessly with their dogs. And when it comes to pickup trucks, you want the same qualities. The all-new Chevy Silverado comes with an available 4G Wi-Fi hotspot for seamless communication. It's designed to handle the toughest loads with advanced trailering technology, tough on the road and off. And the all-new design gives you more cargo space than the competition. Chevy Silverado is the most dependable, longest-lasting, full-size pickup on the road. Plus, there's never been a better time to see your local Chevy dealer about the Big Fix lease. It's an amazing lease deal that can lower your monthly payments and give you more Chevy, all for less money. That's a treasure hunt. So head to your Chicagoland and Northwest Indiana Chevy dealer or go to ChevyDriveChicago.com and see why Chevy is the number one best-selling brand in Chicagoland, now 8 years running.
It's Charlie Potter and the Great Outdoors on Chicago's very own 720 WGN.
Welcome back to the Great Outdoors Show. Charlie Potter, your host here on WGN Radio. And if you're just joining me and just waking up, yes, it's Mother's Day. Please don't forget that. It's important to us as dads when it's Father's Day, and believe me, it's more important to our wives that it's Mother's Day. So, we're visiting with Carrie Luft, who is the Executive Vice President of the Max McGraw Wildlife Foundation and the head of the McGraw Center for Conservation Leadership, and we've been talking about this effort to recruit people and retain people to go out field and go hunting and its issues. And Carrie won't rehash the first part of the show, but before the break I said, say we're successful at having this massive recruitment effort, where are they supposed to go and what are they supposed to hunt?
Well, Charlie, you hit the nail on the head. I mean, I think usually the normal response when people say, well, they don't have access. Well, maybe so, but let's take it to the point where you and I, the hunting that you and I love best, waterfowling. There are public opportunities out there, but where are the ducks? Where are they? I mean, if you want to have a recipe for turning off a kid to duck hunting, wake him up at dark 0:30, or her. I have daughters, and they have both been out with me. Wake them up at 0:30, take them out in the cold, might be raining, might be misty, put them in a cold blind, tell them, isn't this great, and proceed to stare at empty skies for 4 hours. What is any child of 10 years old going to say at the end of that experience? I suspect it's not going to be, can't wait to do it again, Dad. We have, as you know, and as we have discussed in private, Charlie, many of the traditional areas for hunting waterfowl in this country no longer are productive. The eastern shore of Maryland, once the Mecca, along with southern Illinois, of Canada goose shooting, has dropped to a one-bird limit. The Illinois River, while it's still great hunting in certain spots, it is in by no means at the historic levels of waterfowl that there once were.
And so,
yes, there are places where there are still plenty of ducks to shoot, but they're not readily accessed without great effort and a good bit of money.
So you raised something here, why I think this effort to recruit and retain hunters is going to be an abysmal failure, but it's going to be something at which we throw goodness knows how many hundreds of millions of dollars at, without the ability to solve it, because it's a very complex issue. But just simplifying it, I can name, and so can you, and those of you listening, many of you may feel fall into this category. Places that you went as a child, or more recently as an adult, where you went duck hunting in Wisconsin or Illinois, and you stopped going, not because you don't like to duck hunt, but because there were no ducks, as you just said. The number of places and clubs on the Illinois River and the Wisconsin River and out on the Mississippi that have folded is not because people had a lack of interest. It's because they had a lack of opportunity. And if we switch it to pheasants, there aren't any pheasants unless you go to a pheasant preserve or you go to South Dakota. So you have to travel. So it's part of the problem we have here that we had the baby boom generation after World War II with lots of access, but more importantly, lots and lots of people, lots of kids with game to hunt, rabbits, squirrels. Who hunts a rabbit or a squirrel anymore? Nobody. And yet we have plenty of rabbits and squirrels.
Sure. Why has, and, you know, this is probably another show, and I might not be the right person to do it, but if kids, let's face it, I think some kids are getting exposed to the idea of hunting through television shows. And some of them are great, but some of them are just simply portrayals of things that are nothing like the typical experience you're going to have if you go out for the first time in a public setting. You're not going to see, you may, but the odds of seeing a monster buck walking under your stand on a state wildlife facility is slim. The idea that you're going to go out into a field or a marsh in Illinois, a public marsh, and see the clouds of ducks that pile in on the duck commander is unlikely. So there are expectations, and a kid who is looking at these shows, and I looked at them myself as a kid, you watched them, I'm sure, as well, and think that's how it is, and then is finally confronted with reality, that's going to be a hard putt for almost anybody to convince that child to retain interest. And I'm sorry, I sound very down on this, but I think it's the truth based on my experience with my own children.
So in the couple minutes we have left, is this effort, which has now been embraced by everybody, it seems like, in the conservation community, driven by the states, but also driven now by the conservation community, which sees dollar signs in this problem. Is this something we should be spending the amount of time and money we're spending on versus the more historical issues?
Well, Charlie, I think if I were to sum up and my attitude toward this, which I think you probably share, I agree with the means to the, with the end goal of this. I would love to see more hunters out there because of all the myriad reasons. I mean, it would help fund conservation. It would help more people understand the role that responsible hunting has in conservation. It would be good for our legacy as hunters. Even if they don't hunt, the exposure and the understanding of what we do is very important.
Thank you for being on the show this morning. Thank you for listening very much. And to you mothers out there, happy Mother's Day. This is Charlie Potter on the Outdoor Voice of Chicago and America, 720 WGN.